Good evening, everyone. It's 8:31 on my computer. It's September 14th, 2020, and we continue with my latest book. As is our wont, let me revisit a couple things from last class. Let me share a screen here for a second, if I can. Should be able to, yes. On the wrong screen. Now I will. I'm going to set the sound also because I'm going to be showing you some things. Sound, why can't I get my picture that I want to show you? Ah, here it is. Okay. I was asked last class, we mentioned Rebbetzin Sarah Schwartzman. And she studied in Columbia for a PhD. She never completed her PhD, but here, look at the top of right hand there. You see, that was the PhD subject, that topic that she was going to be writing on, the dissertation. The Rapaki Plan, a study of Polish and Soviet approaches to arms control and the German problem, Columbia. You can look up what the Rapaki Plan is on your computer. This was sent to me from someone in her family when they heard my classes on Rivera and Cutler. So this is doctoral dissertations in political science in the United States in 1967, what was it, year it is, yeah, in it was published in 1968. So they listed all the dissertations currently in progress, and as we just saw, we have Schwartzman, although never completed. But the fact that she was doing that is quite significant. One of the listeners asked me what was the reason for the divorce. So let me just tell you, Shmuel, listen, no one knows what goes on inside a marriage. And I wouldn't want to even speculate, but it's one thing to talk about years ago what happened, but the children are alive. I'll just tell you, in the yeshiva world, they say that she was very modern, and you see, I mean, she's going to get a PhD. She was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention, and Rabbi Schwartzman, although he was very open-minded, I spent the whole Shabbos with him, as I mentioned, and I know people who studied with him, he still was just only Torah, and maybe that was the reason. I don't know. There's another marriage in the Cutler family, however, which is also of interest because people have discussed it, and that's the current Rosh Yeshiva of Lakewood, Malkiel Cutler, because this is famous, and this created a whole literature. He, when his father, Rav Schneur, died, he wanted to come back to America and take over the yeshiva, and his wife, who was the granddaughter of the Brisker Rav, Rav Yechiel Michal Feinstein's daughter, she refused to go, and this created a big controversy. He got a Heter Meir Rabbanim to remarry, and she, as far as I know, never remarried again and refused to accept the get. This caused a split between Ponovej, Rav Shach, and the Briskers, because the Briskers, of course, opposed Rav Malkiel Cutler and what he was doing, and leaving Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Shach, who was one of the people who gave the Heter Meir Rabbanim. It even entered the realm of Jewish writings, because here you have a book that appeared, which I have. It's a rare book. It sort of was like undercover writings. It has the tshuva of Rav Yankel Schiff, that's another of the Brisker Rav's son-in-laws, and other Rabbanim. And you could see it's about the Heter Meir Rabbanim that comes from Muncie, Lahatir Lamalkiel Kutner. They don't even give him the title rabbi. But this has created a huge issue in the Haredi world. So everyone knows about that. There's no need to not to mention it. That's the first thing I wanted to say. Let's see. Second thing. I'll say it again. I'm taking you back now to a previous class because of Ruvain from Paris. The issue, the dispute with the Langer case, where Rav Gorin gave the heter. By the way, I have some great pictures of Rav Gorin. Here, I don't need to make you wait for them since I have them handy. So let me just. Show you a nice picture which I've discovered. Here, hold on a second. because I know many people here love Rav Soloveitchik and love Rav Gorin. Here you go. This is a picture of the Rav and Rav Soloveitchik, which I discovered. I'll explain where I found all this stuff later on when I post it. Here you have also the Rav, Rav Gorin. That's Rabbi Israel Miller. Here you have, you see, that's Rabbi Harlop on the left before he had a beard. Dr. Belkin and Rabbi Miller, and here you have the Rav Gorin giving a shiur. This is from May of 1972. I'm going to post all these. I don't think I'll get a chance to put them on the Bosforum blog before Rosh Hashanah, but I'll do it in the middle of Rosh Hashanah because I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to show a picture of Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Gorin and talk about how Rav Aaron Cutler wanted Rav Gorin to be his son-in-law. He was the Eloi of Yeshiva Seitz Chaim, and then later of Chevron. So let me take that away, though. I'll give you something to look forward to. But the issue of the Langer case, I'm going to say it again, Reuven from Paris, because I think maybe I didn't say it correctly. What I thought I said was that Rav Avadya Yosef never accepted the decision halachically, but after Rabbi Gorin gave his ruling, Rabbi Avadya Yosef said, okay, the matter is done. And I don't know what that means, the matter is done. There's a letter in Hapardes, I'm holding it now, from Tevet, Tavshin Lamed Gimel, in which Rav Avadya Yosef writes that what the newspapers have been reported that I basically barachti al-kach, that I blessed this decision, was not true. And Rav Avadya says, what I said was that since we need to do work in the rabbinate, we need to achieve things, we can't keep having this fight. So that's what I meant when I said it's over. Does that mean that Rav Avadya Yosef still regard the children as mamzerim, or that he disagreed with Rav Gorin, but since Rav Gorin's based and ruled that they're kosher, that he agreed ex post facto? Or he doesn't say that. He simply says he opposed it. He opposed Rav Gorin's based in. And but in order so that the rabbinate can go forward, the chief rabbinate, he's saying enough. Okay, let's move on. So I thought I said that, but if I didn't, here it is. Okay, and the last thing I want to discuss before moving forward, many people, including from Israel, wrote to me about mitzvah tanses. So let me spend just a couple minutes, and then I'm going to show you something which I forgot mention last class, and I think you'll find it of interest. And Baruch, I'll get to your point next week about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, just because I want to move. We have a Dayan who listens to us. He's a Hasidish Dayan, and he informs me that as far as he knows, other than Chabad, he thinks that all Hasidim do the mitzvah tans. Now, there's different types of mitzvah tanses. I'll show you again. When the Rebbe does it, it's with a gartel. He says, though, for the mitzvah tans we saw last class, it's usually done at the end, and it's basically for family or very close friends. Obviously, if a Rav Ratzabi, as we saw last week, a nephew or a brother-in-law is not supposed to be seeing a woman dance. But in fact, in the tshuva we read last week from Rav Ratzabi, if you look on page top of 158, he says, they said that he quotes the Nadvorna Rebbe, who was very strict on this, commanded the men not to look at the dance, and even the musicians, he says that they have to look up to the wall, turn around and look to the wall while they play, so they don't see them dance. But I want to show you some examples, more examples of mitzvah dance, a couple more of Rebbe's in particular, and then I'm going to show you something also, which I think will blow you away. In addition, I told you, I promised you, I would show you. Promised I'd show you this picture. Oops, that's the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, doing. He had a Hasidic side too. He was not a Hasid on neither side of his parents was a Hasid, but he had Hasidic training as a youth in Chaslovich. A famous story that his father gave him to the Muhammad, and then. Weeks or even months later, perhaps, he found that all he was learning was Tanya. This Malamed survived, and when you had people from YU who went to Israel with student struggle or one of the Soviet Jewry things, They actually, he was, they met him there once. But the Rav had a Hasidic side to him as well. And here you see him doing the mitzvah tants. I don't know of any other Litvish who've ever done a mitzvah tants. I'll show you some examples of Hasidic Rebbe's. This, I published this picture, which I received from David Eisen. I think he got it from Rabbi Rekefet. And I just published it as a woman, an anonymous woman. Lo and behold, this is the sister who passed away earlier this year, Gladys Rice, I think it's pronounced, or Reese, of Rabbi Alvin Marcus, the rabbi in West Orange for many decades. I thank Chaim Dalfin, Chaim Dalfin, who's published a number of books. Here it is. Chabad and Gedolin. He has all these books on the Rav. They're full of all sorts of, it's like you're reading the National Enquirer. It's not a scholarly work, but it's full of all sorts of interesting stuff, and it's goodies. So he identified Gladys Rice. So I asked him, how did you know who this was? And when I showed it to Rabbi Marcus's family, I mean, they knew about the wedding and everything. They were there. His wife told me, but they didn't know the picture. But the picture, it was told to Dalfin by Gladys Rice's son. He showed him the picture, and then, of course, I posted it, so he identified it. So here you see the Rav doing something very interesting. But let me show you just some. Do I have you? Hold on. I want to make sure I have you sound here. I want to show you a few more mitzvah tanses, and then I want to show you. Something which goes beyond the mitzvah dance, the mitzvah dance. For the Hasidim, it's the mitzvah dance. It's not just having fun. There's all sorts of mystical significance. And the Rebbe, whenever the Rebbe comes in, if it's the, let's say the Rebbe comes in the middle of the wedding, then he'll dance with the kallah. They make a giant deal when it's his children. So, but and those dances are not done at the end. Everyone sees it. So here is from Kapichenitz, Uzerov. So take a look at, you give an example of what they do here. And if you read the comments on the various websites, you always have Misnagdim saying this is completely unsnias, shouldn't be done. I did a Google search and I came up with this article, The Mitzvah Tants Forbidden or Kosher Minhag by Rabbi Yair Hoffman, who's I guess a Litvisha type. I mean, the very question for Hasidim would be regarded as a disgraceful question, a chutzpahdik question. What do you mean, forbidden or kosher minhag? That's the minhag of all the Hasidim. He begins his article, the mitzvah tants is one of the greatest controversies that still remain of the Hasid Misnagid divide. When Misnagdim first hear about it, they are in a state of shock. Hasidim dancing with a kala and a gartel? As we already saw, it's not with a gartel. For many Hasidim, it's actually you dance hands on. The Rebbe doesn't, but the Hasan does. On the other hand, when someone raises the question, the response from Hasidim is one of pure shock. How dare you cast aspersions on one of our minhagim? And for a Hasid, you just would stop reading the article right now. What does he need to read about Rabbi Hoffman's analysis, whether it's kosher or not? The fact that all the rabbis do it makes it kosher. But so here is Kapichenitz. Oops. Okay, I don't know what happened there. Let me try again here. So you see there, the bride doesn't do anything. She just stands there. I have some other examples. Here's Bubov. Look at all the Hasidim there. So you see, for a non-chassid, this is completely inappropriate. You have thousands of men staring at the bride and all that. Here we have from Skver. Skver, I see Mel Barinholtz is with us. He'll remember when we were in Central Europe, we met the Skver Rebbe. Skver Rebbe comes every single year to Europe to take in the cure, as they used to call it at the baths. Why he doesn't go to Saratoga Springs? Well, because his forefathers didn't go to Saratoga Springs. So he comes, he stays, they take over the small hotel in Bratislava, that's Pressburg, And during the week, it's just a few of them. And on weekends, Hasidim come from America, they come from all over Europe. When we were there, you had all these young men from high school age from Antwerp who still speak Yiddish. That's their native language. And these are very, like, these are Hasidic or Yeshivish, whatever they have in Antwerp. I remember being struck by the fact that although they were 15, 16, 17, they wore regular clothes. They're speaking Yiddish, but they didn't dress like in America. Once you go into high school, you're in some black pants, white shirt. But they would come to the square, Rebbe, and we were told where he was, not far from our hotel, and we walked over, and we got to go in and meet him. So here's Skver. Okay, sure enough. Now I want to show you, though. Okay, let me show you Satmar first before I get to the other one. Here's a Satmar. For some reason, I don't know why, my sound is not good. Okay, and finally, before I get to the interesting one, Mordechai Ben David. Okay, so that's his granddaughter, and the people are not just family. But now I want to show you Carlin Stolen, because something happened which made all the news, the Haredi news, and the regular news. First, I want to show you, in case you're thinking that it's only done by family, here is Carlin. It's called her a bride who's not very happy. And if you look at her, she doesn't look very happy, maybe because she's taught to be modest and not be public. And here she's in front of hundreds and hundreds. But here's, and then I'll stop it and then I'll explain here. Okay, so she then goes back. She's finished her dance. This is the daughter of the stolen Rebbe. His name is Rebaruch Shochet. My parents are listening. My father probably remembers. When I was 12 years old, I went to see the stolen Rebbe. We had a private meeting with me and my father, my brother, and the stolen Rebbe. Now, why would I, at 12 years old, first of all, what 12-year-old even knows about the stolen Rebbe? But he was a young man. He was born in, let's see, that would have been 1978. The stolen Rebbe was 23 then. He was when his father died when he was very young, I think 1 year old, and he was made Rebbe, I think, at nine or something. They declared he'd be Rebbe, but he didn't start taking over till he was like 18, because I had been reading Hasidic works about Hasidim, and he seemed like interesting. He knew English. In those days, for a Rebbe to know English was unusual because he's young. He grew up in America from around 10 years old. And lo and behold, I mentioned this, or my father mentioned it to our neighbor. His name was Herman Sherman. His brother, he passed away, unfortunately, but his brother is Nussin Sherman, Rabbi Nussin Sherman, who before Art Scroll even existed. So I don't know when the first Art Scroll work came out. So this is before, maybe even when I was 11. Nussin Sherman was the principal. I think he was the secular studies principal of the stolen yeshiva in Borough Park. And he arranged. So we get there, I'm coming to see the Rebbe. And the Rebbe wants to know what I'm doing there. I don't know what. I have nothing to say. I guess I just wanted to meet him. So this is the Rebbe's daughter. Now, they finished the mitzvah tans. Now watch what happens. And then I'll play you something that appeared on Israeli television, because this has never been seen before, at least widely. And apparently now it's going to be a tradition in Stolen. The Stolen Rebbe is very open-minded. He believes in smartphones, as long as they're you have like a... protection, whatever they call it on it. But watch what happens, and you're not going to believe it, but here it goes. And they call it back. Okay, the people there are the Rebbe, his son-in-law, and his mechutan. That is, so the son-in-law's father. So the son-in-law's father is not related in any halachic way to the kala. Thank you. So here you have a Hora, a mixed Hora, where you have someone who's not halachically related doing this dance. Now, granted, the couple's holding hands of the Rebbe and her husband, but still, the other guy in there is, so this was shocking, as you can imagine. In fact, there was a whole thing, just those who know Hebrew will appreciate this. It's the video which is creating all this controversy in the Haredi world, the Admor dancing with his daughter. So here's, I'll just play it for about a minute.
לתמונות הללו מחתונת ביתו של האדמור מקרלין סטולין לא רגילים במגזר החרדי. לנגד עיניהם של מאות מחסידיו הזמין האדמור, הרב ברוך שוחט, את הקלה, ביתו הקטנה, לרקוד איתו. חסידים רבים צפו בעבר באדמורים שלהם רוקדים מבנותיהם ביום כלולותיהן, אך תרם צפו בריקוד כזה, מראה חריג של האדמור רוקד במעגל אחד עם ביתו, בעלה אתרי ואביו.
בדרך כלל בכל חסידות האדמור רוקד עם החבל, עם הגרטל הזה, עם הקלה, אבל במקרה של חסידות קרלין האדמור החליט אתמול לחדש מסורת מיוחדת שהוא רוקד יד ביד עם החתן ועם הקלה בריקוד מעגלי. וכך ראינו את הריקוד הנפוץ הזה שהפך להיות ויראלי מאוד ברשת.
Okay, so whether this will spread to other Hasidic groups, I don't know. Okay, that's incidentally, anyone's interested to know about Karlin Stolen, the great Benny Brown. Okay, I don't know how he does it. He's like Jacob Neusner and what he publishes, but everything is so great. He came out with this huge book. Look how thick it is. It's 600 pages, which is 800 pages, I would think, in English. And it's all about Chassidut Karlin, Ben Aliot and Mashberim. Karlin is stolen, and it's maybe the oldest of the Hasidic groups going back to Lithuania. They're known for their enthusiastic singing and dancing, but there were Stolener Hasidim in America, in Detroit, already in the 1920s. And if anyone knows the name Yechiel Goldhaber, this great, great scholar in Israel, he comes from an old Karlin Stolen family in America. Okay, let us pick up now where we are. We're in the Sefer Simon Samachet, page 160, and the question is, b'minhag shehabat sheyegiya lemitzvot deresh of Beit HaKnesset, the practice, the custom, that a girl who becomes bat mitzvah, she speaks to the congregation, gives a drasha, Devar Torah. What's this about? So here, let me explain what happened here. I was asked, it was somehow, it was known among certain circles that I wrote to different rabbis. And remember, there used to be an organization called Eda. Let me remind people who don't remember what Eda was. Eda was an organization. Now the only thing that's left of Eda is this website. Eda opened in 97 and closed in 2006. It was supposed to, I think they had a slogan, the courage to be modern and orthodox. And it was about, pushing back against the turn to the right. Not the turn to the right in the Haredi world, they don't care about that. The turn to the right in the modern orthodox world, from modern orthodox to centrism. I mean, we've all lived through it, or most of us. You know how things are different today than they were, let's say, in the 70s. So this organization was founded. It was heavily funded, and they put on some unbelievably interesting conferences. Lots of money. The money dried up. It's not that interest dried up. The money dried up, so it closed. Saul Berman was the head of it. I don't know where the... on this website here, you can watch actually some things. They still have it here, some lectures, but all the talks from the conferences, I don't know where they are. What happened to them? The only thing that remained of Eda is the Eda Journal. That's the only thing. There is this organization that opened up Horat, which you can look at it. It's the same sort of thing as Eda, except it's not, it's, they're happy to have a conference every now and then now on Zoom. It's not aiming to remake orthodoxy, so you don't need as much money. We'll see if anything happens with that. Alan Brill, who's written so much about orthodoxy, he basically argued that Eda, and if you look at same as with Porat, it was founded by lay people, not by rabbis. And well, you had some rabbis in it, but it was, Alan Brill makes the claim that all the people who used to have an impact in Orthodoxy, the journalists, the academics, you know, the people with wealth, all the people who used to have something to say with centrism, they no longer have any say because everything has now become rabbinic. The rabbis are the center. You look in centrist communities, everything revolves around the rabbis. There's even almost a notion of Das Torah in much of centrism. It's a Zionist Das Torah that you go for the rabbis for everything. And whereas for the typical modern Orthodox, the rabbis are important for halachic matters, but other people have a lot to say as well. And that was the story there. But it didn't really succeed. The one lasting impact, I think, is this article that appeared in the second of the Eda Journal, Kriyat HaTorah by Women, a Halachic Analysis by Mendel Shapiro, who was a lawyer, who I had never heard of. No one I knew had heard of him before that. He published an article saying that basically women can read the Torah. There's no problem with women reading the Torah from their side of the Mechitza. Then, you know, you could split the Torah reading. And then that led into other matters, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat, things that women could do. As soon as this article appeared, it led to a couple minyanim, they call them partnership minyanim, where the women are involved in, they read the Torah, they get aliyahs, or they even read the Torah, and then it led to them doing other things, maybe Pesukah Zimra, but it began with Kriyas the Torah. It meant that women's prayer groups, which in the 80s were considered, I guess, cutting edge and radical, where women would get together and do their thing, they became sort of passé and conservative with a small c, because this was the new path to take. It always struck me as strange because I don't know of any other example where an article by an Orthodox rabbi, not of any renown, and just an article, all of a sudden now people start changing the practice in the synagogue and adopting completely new practices. Later on, Daniel Sperber, who has more significance, I'm not going to say he's a posek, but extremely learned, so he came down in favor of this as well. So it's a different situation. But Orthodox communities started following this article just because it appeared. I remember saying once, Ethan Tucker also wrote an article, and Joel Roth wrote an article saying count women for a minyan. Actually, I didn't say Ethan Tucker, I said Joel Roth. I said Ethan Tucker later. And they said, well, he's not Orthodox, so which means that if Joel Roth was Orthodox, then you could count women for a minyan. The whole thing struck me as quite strange. But I wanted actually to do a paper on this because I had this whole theory that what you're seeing now with the liberal Orthodox is completely at odds with traditional Orthodoxy, and it's going back to an era where the rabbis, the poskim, are sort of put into a box, and they're not the leaders at all of the community. They're technicians. In a way, Hasidim do this. In most Hasidic circles, the posek is just the technician, but the spiritual leader, of course, is the Rebbe. So I wrote up a whole paper when I was at the AJS conference, Association of Jewish Studies conference. I saw a sign for the Jofa conference. So I thought it was an academic sort of conference for Jofa, Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. So I submitted a whole description of a paper where I would make the argument that the people who are adopting this approach, we shouldn't consider them Orthodox, because Orthodoxy isn't identical with halachically observant. It's not identical for Torah true. Orthodoxy is a certain phenomenon that's been around for the last couple hundred years. If we ever get back to our history of Gedolim, we could talk about the beginning of the rise of the Reform movement in response. So for instance, in Orthodox synagogues, you can't read the prayers in English or in the vernacular. And yet the Chazal, the Mishnah says you can read in vernacular, the Rambam says, Shulchan Aruch says, why is it that we can't read in the vernacular? Well, because it's not Orthodox. Orthodox is not always identical with halacha. The rabbis, the Gedolim, play a very important role here. And in the modern Orthodox, and in centrist Orthodox, the Gedolim also play a role. But I said that this was going back to a different period before Orthodoxy. And I compared it to Ibn Kaspi. Ibn Kaspi has this whole thing. Professor Tursky loved this, that he talks about how once a spoon fell in, I don't know if it was a dairy or meat, whatever, and he took it to the rabbi to ask him if he could eat the spoon. He ate with the spoon or needed to be kashered. And he says, and I'm not embarrassed by it. I'm not troubled that I don't know this, because why do I need to know it? That's why we pay these rabbis. Their job is to know this. I know philosophy and I know theology, and that's much more important than being a technician and knowing about some halachic thing here. Needless to say, Jofa turned me down. They didn't want to hear it because, I mean, someone's saying that this is not functioning in accord with orthodoxy. And I still don't think it is, because the idea that just because someone writes it, you go ahead and change the practice. In any event, I wasn't saying it's not halachic. I wasn't talking halachic. I was talking about as a sociological phenomenon. Okay, so Eidah, though, when it was around, they approached me. They wanted to do a project on bat mitzvah. Makes sense for Eidah, focusing on women and girls. And they wanted me to write to all the rabbis, knowing I wrote to them. And they hired me. They paid me. They paid me $500. So it's a lot of money in those days, to write to different rabbis and ask them about girls saying, giving a divrei Torah during davening. And I remember saying to them, it was actually Rabbi Michael Breut who contacted me for Eidah, I think for Rabbi Saul Berman, saying that the rabbis I write to, they're not the sort of rabbis who would be happy with a girl. I can tell you already that they're not going to be happy with this. So why do you want me to write? And in our communities, the women do, girls do this anyway. So what's the point? And they said, no, we want halachic texts discussing it. And they said, it's fine if they oppose it. So I sent out a number of letters, only got three responses. That's the thing when you send out these letters to the rabbis, they're not always responding, or sometimes they just send back with a one-line letter. So I got three letters that we're going to look at. And let me first read you, well, first tell you the first one I wrote it to, Rav Ezra Basri. You might recall Rav Ezra Basri. We saw him before. Now we can get rid of this. Here is Ezra Basri. Oh, there he is. He's an Av-Bastin in Jerusalem. He also was the chief rabbi, Sephardic rabbi, or Av-Bastin, I should say, in London for a number of years. Well, he lived in Israel. He'd go back. And also, he was chief rabbi of Spain for a number of years. So he's not enclosed in like yeshiva world. He's been out there. He's the one that wrote the book. When I was searching for a picture of him, it came up. They had a whole party celebrating his last volume of Tshuvot that appeared. And it's a Sefer Chadash, a new Sefer that the Dayan wrote, deals with the issue of cheating on your income tax in America. Remember, we spoke about that. I told you about that case that was in the book. And it's interesting that in the Haredi site, Kikar Shabbat, they picked up also on that particular tshuva, which the guy from Lakewood is, I don't need to go into it again. You can go back to the previous classes. But so the first person I wrote to, well, I wrote to a bunch of them. This is the first one, Rabbi Basri. Let me first read you the letter I wrote. I begin by saying here in America, pretty much all the datiyim, not the charedim, the non-charedim, modern Orthodox, whatever you want to call it, have a bat mitzvah. I think for the charedim today, they also have it. But I said the datiyim, and I said they do a sudas mitzvah, they have a party. And during the meal, the girl will say a dvar Torah in front of the community, boys, men and women together. And I said, this is very natural in our communities, in which men and women sit together at events like this, and no one says it's an issue. I've even seen, the Gedolei Yisrael of the centrist community. I've been to weddings. They're sitting with their wives. It's not, and at the weddings of the Litvisher Gedolim also used to be, they'd sit together. And then I say there are also places where the girl speaks in the synagogue after davening. So for instance, in my synagogue's the more liberal one in West Orange. After davening, the girl will get up and give a dvar Torah. You know, the typical speech you all know, give a dvar Torah, then thank your parents, and this and that, make jokes about her siblings and how annoying they are. We all know that. And then I say, in some places, she'll speak from the Ezras Nashim. I've seen that where the girl will stand in the Ezras Nashim and give the dvar Torah. And in others, she'll speak before the Aron Kodesh, that is, get right up on the bima, right at the bar mitzvah. While the other girl, it's really the same thing as I said before, when I said that she speaks in the shul after davening, But I think I meant to say that she speaks during davening. That's what I meant. I didn't make it so clear. But she gets up, the girl gets up in front of the Aron Kodesh, just like the bar mitzvah boy. In my mind, I know, you know, you often would do this before Musaf. And the rest of the women stay in their place. And after her words, the rabbi speaks to her on the significance of the day, maybe he gives her a book of Tehillim, the Chumash, etc. Just like with the bar mitzvah boy. And then I continue, but there are those who say it's not appropriate for the girl to be in the Ezras Anashim, to be in the men's side, even after davening. Like there's some shuls that have a woman president, but they wouldn't want the woman president to speak. It's not appropriate. And if the daughter speaks before the community, these people think it's better to do it just at the meal. So I say, if I want to hear your opinion from halacha and from Musar, from you know, ethics, morality, and understanding the situation of communities in America, do you think that this minhag of girls giving a Devar Torah either at the meal or in the shul is kosher? And then I say, I also have to note that even those who oppose it, oppose the girl speaking, they don't oppose it from halacha. After all the people in the modern Orthodox shuls, women have jobs, they're teachers, they work, they're working, they speak all the time in front of men. But they say that this is new and chadash is asur. You can't go in the synagogue. Has to be they think it has to be the last refuge of where we keep tradition. And some of them, I say, many of them even oppose the bat mitzvah. And they say, at least in the Beit Knesset, in the shul, we should keep the tradition that only men speak. And incidentally, that is found in many shuls. They'll have a scholar in residence, let's say it was a woman, but this will be after davening or later, but in davening they won't. And some centrist shuls are not even comfortable with a woman speaking for men, no matter when. And then I say, some say it's okay if the girl speaks in the women's section, but not in the men's section. And I say that in America, every shul does what they want. There's no rules. There's some, oh, here I say there's some that the girls will speak even in the middle of Musaf, very liberal, before Musaf, very liberal shuls. And in these synagogues, I say sometimes you have a female president who at the end of davening will announce the Tachnit HaShavua, the plan of the week. And in these communities, no one opposes this because that's not considered unusual that a woman speaks. And then I say, even Yeshiva University honors women at its events, and these women speak before the community. YU does it all the time. They'll give an honor a woman, and she'll speak at events all the time. And then I say, would anyone say that it's forbidden for men to have heard the shiurim of Nechama Leibowitz? So, here is a picture I have here of Nechama Leibowitz as I remembered her. I have her. Here she is. How would I know Nechama Leibowitz? Because when I was in BMT in 84 to 85, she taught. Let me just read the next sentence. I say, Derech Agav, for many years, she gave shiurim to the students at the Gruss Kollel, which is connected to Yeshiva University in Jerusalem. YU has a kollel. I call it a kollel, but it's the third year or second year. Guys will go. You can do the whole time if you want. In Israel, they would encourage them. It was never a requirement. Guys going for Simcha at YU, it was a three-year program then. Now it's 4 years. Would go spend 1 year in Israel. In addition to the learning of the people in Gruss, Rabbi Miller, they also would hear shiurim from Avraham Lichtenstein. Rabbi Rakefet came in once a week and gave them now he does it twice a week. In those days, it was once a week. He spoke on history. And Nechama Leibowitz came in once a week and gave shiurim on Tanakh. So here you have Nechama Leibowitz, a woman, giving shiurim. So then I asked to tell me what the proper approach is, what are the gedarim, what we need to be worried about from halacha, does everything depend on the place and the time? In other words, maybe it's not a halachic matter at all, it's just a place and the time. Is it permissible for a bat mitzvah to speak in the synagogue when she's in the Ezra Gvarim, the men's side, or only in the time of the meal? If it's permissible in the synagogue, should it only be done after davening? All the questions, which I never would have asked, but they wanted me to, and they were paying me to. Only later did I find out that sometimes you see in Sfarim, like there was big controversies. For instance, in Italy, there was a big controversy. I think the one I'm referring to is the mikvah in Rovigo. There was in Rovigo, Italy, there's a big controversy about the mikvah. And you have two or three different books all giving different opinions. Leon Mudner, the great rabbi of Venice, in his autobiography mentions that he was hired by the one side in this dispute to write a tshuva. In other words, he didn't have to believe in it. He didn't have to agree with it. He just was hired to write it. It's no different than the lawyers we have listening to us now. You'll be paid. You'll write a brief. You don't have to believe it, but your job is to present the best case. We have a Tohen Rabbani. We have rabbinic lawyers who are hired to go before a Beis Din. Their job is just to present the best case. And so now we know that you have to vote occasionally, where the rabbi doesn't necessarily even agree with what he's writing, but he's just, hey, if we publish all the documents of the Tohen Rabbanim, we'd see examples of that as well. So I wrote up these questions, and I thought I did a good job. And Rav Basri answers me as follows. He says, you analyze this very well. He says, "Bebechinat shelat chacham chatzi tshuva." That's a rabbinic phrase. The question of a wise one is half the answer. That is, I presented all the matters. And since the question depends on the minhag and the certain mentality, he says, I can't put it in print like I do most questions. Again, this is a rabbi who was working also as the chief rabbi in Spain, community, you know, a typical, most people, they're not even that religious, who was in England as well. So he knows the situation. He says, I can only give a ruling when I visit the place and I see the community. And even with this, I don't know if I can give an answer in print or only baal peh because of an emergency ruling. What does it mean when a big dayan says to you, I can only give you the answer orally, I can't write it down? I think it means one of two things. Either one, he's afraid of being attacked when his colleagues hear about his liberal answer, or two, he's afraid that people will apply his ruling if he gives a liberal ruling to another case that he didn't intend it. Whatever the case is, he's telling you that this is one of these cases that don't expect me to write down my answer. I'll give it to you orally. And then he says, because what's suitable in one place, I don't know what'll be the next generation. So he says that's the reason. Not because he's afraid of being attacked, but because he doesn't know, he doesn't want to make it a permanent ruling. Then he says, if your community's in Manhattan, it could be I'll be there after Sukkot and we can meet and we can talk about it. He says, because from the style of your question, I understand that you're chacham u'pikeach, you're a wise man, and you'll understand in a remez, in a hint, what I can't write. So he's saying basically, even though he says the reason is I don't want to write it in print because a future generation they'll apply it, he's also saying you understand what I'm hinting at here, which leads me to believe that what he's really talking about is that he's afraid to put it in print because extremists will attack him. Because after all, that what's the remez? He already said explicitly the one consideration that maybe things will change and he doesn't want his ruling to be permanent. But there's a second consideration that he says you understand. And that's what I believe it is. Then we come to the next question. So that's non-committal. Nothing to send back to Adam. The next one is from Rav Shlomo Aviner. Leading figure in the right-wing religious Zionist world, the Chardali world, of that group we spoke about called the Kav. And let me just give a fair warning. Don't be upset with me. I'm just reading you what he says. And some of what he says is a little strange. I think at least one thing, but I'm not saying it. He said it. So, you know, some things he's very, very good at. And you'd be very happy, but women's issues, you wouldn't if you went to the women's issues. But he says one thing that I think you're going to find offensive. Well, let me read it. He says, and by the way, in this Chardali world, they're very conservative with a small c when it comes to women's issues. To a certain extent, even more conservative than the Haredim. So for instance, in the Chardali world, girls' skirts have to go down to the floor. In the Haredi world, not only do girls' skirts not go down to the floor, they're not allowed to bring it down to the floor because that's considered stylish or imitating the Chardalim. You'll never see in the Haredi world women's skirts go down to the floor. Even though it's a chumrah, you can find sources that say it's better, they were not allowed to do that. Makeup. In these Chardali communities, the women don't wear shadels. Many of them don't wear makeup. When it comes to tzniut, there's no question that they're more extreme than in the Haredi world. He says, it appears that it's impossible to permit a girl to give a talk at her bat mitzvah. Absolutely forbidden. Both from halacha and also that we don't make changes in a shul. He says, from the halacha, it says you're not allowed to look at a attractive woman, even if she's single. And if she's not, in HSC, even if she's not attractive. And he says, a girl who's 12 years old, she's going to be attractive. And if she speaks, everyone's going to look at her. So the idea that you can look at her with just, I mean, someone might say, this is not what I meant, it's offensive. You're saying it's looking at a 12-year-old with sexual thoughts. That's leaving that aside, but he says it's a problem. What I think you might find offensive is what he says now. Remember what I said? I said that Nachama Leibowitz gave a shiur. No one thought anything of it. And yes, when I was there, she was in her 70s giving the shiur. He says, don't compare this to what you said about this Isha Zakena, this old woman who gave shiurim to the students. By the way, she was also giving shiurim, I'm sure, to men when she wasn't so old. He says, without getting into the question of whether they did correctly or not, was why you correct or not, nevertheless, he says, you can't regard her as attractive because she was quite elderly. So that's, I mean, come on now. You're saying about an older woman, she's not attractive? But that's what he says. I guess he prays it differently if he's speaking to a non-rabbinic crowd. He would say, we're not talking about older people, but that's what he says. He says, in other words, he's saying that the students at Grush Kolo could take a class with her because she's elderly. And they're not going to be attracted to her. That's what he says. And then there's the famous case of which I didn't mention, but he mentions it. You heard of the Maiden of Ludmir? There's a famous Hasidic, female Rebbe, let's call her. The Maid of Ludmir, who used to, she had followers, and they would come to her. And but it's known, and Rav Avinir is absolutely correct. She would speak, he says she spoke in a different room. I think it is that they put a curtain. So she would speak from behind a curtain. So she had Hasidim, but they didn't see her. At least so it's reported. So you can't, and they just heard her voice. And he says there are other examples of this. And then he quotes the Rambam, that you can't look at the attractiveness of a woman. And if she's speaking before you, of course you're going to see her. So Rav Avinir says, absolutely, you cannot do this. And then he gets into the second reason. He says, but when you read people like Rav Avinir, who are in the Chardal movement, Haredi Tzili Lomi, basically you can conclude that the only difference between them and the Haredi is that they're also Zionist. But other than that, their outlook in so many issues is identical to the Haredi world, except for they're Zionists and they believe in going to the army, things like that. That's basically putting it with a broad brush. There are other differences, that in certain ways the Haredal community is more liberal, but there's some that even the opposite, the Haredi is more liberal. So he says, we do not make changes in a shul, not in how it's set up, not in the order of davening, even if it's permissible. So for instance, you can get rid of Yikum Korkan. That was the old joke. The reformers, when they're having all the arguments of what they want to get rid of, that the Orthodox said, okay, fine, one thing, we can get rid of Yikum Korkan. But that's it. Nothing else you can get rid of. Although it's really not true, because we've gotten rid of on Tisha B'Av, all these things we used to say when I was a kid. But he says, we don't make any change. The Otsros, how many shuls say Otsros? Maybe you have a Yeki shul, but most of the shuls have gotten rid of them. Any new shul that's opened, I don't think they're going to say the Yitan Lecha, because people are just going to talk. And if you already say it, it's one thing. But so we've made some changes, but he says no. And all this is as a siag, a fence, and zehirut. We have to be careful, because perhaps if you make permissible changes, you'll come to forbidden changes. And that's obviously always an important consideration for the rabbis. You start small, you make some changes that are technically permissible, but who knows where it's going to lead to. We've had plenty of examples. The early reformers started with things that you can make a very good halacha case that they're permissible. And that's a big concern. He says, we've seen this in the past. And he says, therefore, we do not change from what is done through the past generations, with the exception, there is an exception though, only al pi haras gadol yador, only if the leading sages in the generation say you can make a change, then you can make a change. And there have been changes. That was my point. I think he's correct as a as the history of orthodoxy. That was my point against the Mendel Shapiro article and the partnership minyanim, that there was no gadol hador. Now, the thing about the girl speaking and everything, plenty of people, at least I would regard as gadolim, have permitted it. So it wouldn't, that would, you know, put away that that argument. But his basic claim that we don't make changes without the imprimatur of a significant authority, I believe he's historically correct. Then he says, if she speaks from the Ezras Nashim, and you don't see her, you just hear her, which is impossible in most of our shuls because we don't have machitzas to the roof. He says, it's not forbidden, technically, and therefore we can permit it if it's not going to create a dispute in the community. And then he says, everything I'm telling you is only halacha, not maaseh. That is only theoretical, not in practice, because I don't know what's going on in America. He says, you have to ask the Mara d'Asra, who knows the situation. You have to ask the local rabbi, which is exactly what Adad didn't want. They wanted some sort of texts. He says, because the rabbi sometimes will weigh whether something that's permissible should be forbidden, and sometimes the opposite. If something is technically problematic, but if you forbid it, it's going to lead to a worse situation, he could permit it. That's what we spoke about last week. The Rav Yehuda Mintz of Mari Mintz of Padua. The claim was, were they permitting the dancing there? Because there's nothing wrong with it. It's permissible. And that's why they made certain rules. Or, as Rav Ratzabi said, in which I was sympathetic to, basically the rabbis couldn't, they had to take a stand somewhere. They couldn't forbid everything. So they picked the least objectionable that they can. And then he says that you you should ask the post-game, the great post-game in America, because what's in one synagogue doesn't necessarily have to be in another synagogue. No, because in every synagogue is different. In one place, you said she speaks after davening, and sometimes the Ezras Nashim, he says, on all these things that they do in different synagogues, doesn't prove that it's permissible. Who says that the rabbis agree with this? Maybe the people just did it. And then he says the situation changes in every shul. So therefore, he says, you have to ask the great rabbis. So Rabbi Avinir, here you have an example of a really conservative outlook, the Haredili outlook, that, and they have problems, the Haredili world, with their girls. There's no question that they've had dropouts. Look, the Dati have dropouts as well, but it's hard to, you know, they're more in the modern world a little bit because they're Zionists and they participate in things with the State of Israel to tell the girls they can't have. For example, in the Haredili world, you won't have girls learning Gemara. You won't have you won't have everything we know that the modern Orthodox world has with the women speakers, things like that. It's still very conservative. There'll be speakers for women, but so they really function very much like the Haredi world. It's already, well, let me, you know, we have one more tshuva on this, but it's going to take us past our time. Wait, you know what? We can finish up. We'll finish up this last one. The final one was a rabbi, not a famous rabbi. Here's a picture of him. I wrote to him because I had his volume of responsa, and it had his address in it. So where is his picture here? No. His name is Rav Asher Hananya. There's a picture of him. Unfortunately, he passed away. He wasn't 60 even. He passed away a couple of years ago in Jerusalem. He was associated with this Avat Shalom of that Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Hillel. And he has volumes, five volumes of Tshuvot called Asher Hananya. And this was published in volume two. Now here's someone, although he's Sephardic, but his whole life is just spent in a completely Haredi environment. So he, even the question, I'm sure, would have been crazy for him. And he says, I'm going to reply to you that this whole idea of a bat mitzvah, where she, he says, minhag, the minhag that a bat mitzvah speaks in the synagogue in front of men comes from the reformers. Even Rav Avida didn't say that, because it obviously doesn't come from the reformers. Maybe the bat mitzvah itself years ago, but the idea that she speaks, not at all. And the reformers are trying to make the woman and the man equal. And this in all these ways. And this is against the Torah. Because according to the Torah, there's no in, listen to this one. There's no inyan that a girl should speak at her bat mitzvah words of Torah, and not even words of Torah and Musar, because she's putter from learning Torah. Listen to this. A girl is putter from learning Torah, therefore there's no such concept that a girl should speak in Torah. A little bit shocking, because he would acknowledge that girls speak Torah to other girls or women, but that's what he says. And on the contrary, this leads to Isurim, prohibitions, terrible prohibitions. And he says the same thing, Rav Aviner says, that when she's speaking, you're looking at her, and that's problematic, forbidden. Then he says something interesting on section two. He says that sometimes it'll be that you'll enjoy her voice, and therefore, even though she's speaking, that's a violation of Kolisha. He quotes the Chayyadim that normally Kolisha, we say it only applies to singing, but if you enjoy the speaking voice, that's also Kolisha. So you can't do that. And then he mentions that, and when women speak, just like men speak, they rotate their voice, they speak differently. So it's definitely to make it more attractive that you listen to them. And he says that this whole thing, he's not just speaking about a girl's speaking, he's speaking about the having a bat mitzvah celebration. It'll be an opening, like Teheret Asheretz, and Veshegetz Shenashim Shabbat Lanashim Megambri, that basically it's an elite egalitarianism, and that they're going to get up and speak before men without any distinctions, even married ones, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on. He brings a proof that the Midrash says, I think Rashi mentions it also in the Parsha, that Avraham was Megayir the men, Sarah was Megayir the women. So why wasn't Sarah Megayir the men? The answer is because men and women are supposed to be kept separate. And therefore, if the girl wants to speak for the women, it's fine, but not before the men. And he says, if Sarah, who was so snua, did this, all the more so in this generation, that we can't open the door to this sort of thing. And therefore, anyone who has the koach, who's able to abolish this practice, you need to abolish it. But then he says, however, since this terrible thing has already spread in the United States, that a girl speaks at her bat mitzvah, as you've described it to me, it's very difficult to go against the grain in this because this isn't accepted. Therefore, he says, you have to make it at least that the girl only speaks at Kiddush and the Seud, at the meal that they do for relatives and friends. So he acknowledges that, like the Igros Moshe says. People often forget this, that the Sri De'esh, forget the Igros Moshe, the Sri De'esh from Chiyaku Weinberg, who's the great permission for the bat mitzvah, he specifically says it should be done in only in a private gathering, not in shul. He says, dafka, not in shul. Now, it could be that if he was alive today, he'd have a very different view of it, because practices in the Orthodox community can develop independently and have validity. But he does say that, as does Rav Moshe. He says, but to give a drasha in the middle of davening, you have to stop this, but without disputes, because you have to always keep away from disputes, only explain to them nicely, etc., etc. Then he says, if people are not willing to listen and the girl's going to speak, he means even in davening or even after davening, but inside the shul as opposed to in a small group, he says you should go to a different shul where this bad minhag is not found. Although he does, maybe I'm reading too much in it, because he stresses again where the bad minhag that a girl speaks in the middle of davening, but I don't see what the difference is. It's in shul, whether it's in the middle of davening. I think he's just speaking because I use that. But at the end of the day, if the girl speaks in the middle of davening or after davening, this idea that you have in the shuls, I understand in the modern Orthodox shul, we have to wait till after you take off the tallis. Then it's okay to speak. But before the tallis is off, it's not. But from his perspective, the idea that the girl is speaking in the shul to a whole group, which is not just family and close friends, that's a problem. He says you have to leave to go to a different shul, even if you have to walk far. But if there's no other shul near you, and no one's going to listen to you to abolish this, then you should get up and walk out when she speaks in shul. I saw this in person when I lived in West Hartford, Connecticut, in 1995 to 96. Girl would get up at the end of davening, and there was this one man who was very opposed to it. He would get up and walk out, and then come back in afterwards. I think she spoke before Adon Olam, if I recall correctly. This is the young Israel of West Hartford. He says you should get up and walk out as a protest against this minhag. and that you know, God should forgive the sins of Israel. So here we see, I knew exactly what the answers would be before I sent them out, but I was being paid to write it. So, and it's nice, it's interesting to get it in print. It shows you a way of thinking and mentality, which has broken down among some Haredim. They won't, the girls won't speak in shul, but they will speak at events in front of lots of people, which he also thinks is a bad thing. But if you can't institute it, but if people insist on a talk, that's the better alternative. But we see in the Haredi world that in many of the, I guess, more liberal Haredi, I don't know about the more extreme Haredi, the liberal Haredi, they'll have a bat mitzvah for family and some friends, and the girl will speak, and they think that's okay. Where are we going to be when we pick up? We're continuing. Okay, actually, I'll keep you in suspense. You'll see when we get there. Before I take the questions and comments, one more thing that Baruch sent to me. He corrected something we spoke about. I read for you last class the book of the Minhagim of the Yeshiva Torah Vadas, which is published by Torah Vadas, and how Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says that the yeshiva cannot spend money on God kosher, but the people in the Kolel, that he wanted them to. And I spoke about that as being something in the 70s, the change. Actually, we see an example here where it's earlier, as Baruch points out correctly. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky retired from Torah Vadas in 68. So this already in the 1960s, we're seeing the beginning of the God Kosher, and Rav Yaakov fighting against it on a communal level, but still acknowledging that for Kolel people, who are supposed to be above and beyond the average person, that it's... that's something that they, as a chumrah, is something good for them. So thank you, Reb Baruch, you're correct that after 68, he was no longer in Torah Vadas. So let me take the questions and comments here. I don't recall understand the first thing. Linda, our daughter, had a satmar mitzvah tants. The men held a garto but didn't look at her. The bride wore her veil, although it was at the end of the wedding. We women all sat in a row watching everything and talking to each other with much jollity. I don't think it's, though, it's not strangers at the wedding they would hold it. The rabbi holds it, or a father can hold it, or things like that. It's not just strangers holding it. In some Hasidus groups, the man himself, well, I don't know, actually. I think in all the Hasidim who do this, the husband actually holds the hands. With the Rebbes and others, they use the gartels. Baruch says, Rav Yair Hoffman studied Yeshivas Kafetz Chaim, however, he came under Hasidic influence later, via of David Kviat, the Dov Minsk Rebbe, and more. He reviewed one of my books on the Yeshiva World or something. I met him because I was in Jerusalem. We were at the World Congress of Jewish Studies, and I met him there, and he gave me a ride back to my hotel. Yes, Mel recalls he was very friendly to us. We went to Davin Ma'ariv. He was, the Sfer Rebbe was in a separate room, but we were brought in that room, and we shook his hand, and we didn't really speak to him, but they all were very friendly, the Skverers there. Skver is known as like almost like a cult in the sense that they have special minhagim, that you have to do it exactly the way they do it, but... you can't make any changes on anything, your meals, etc. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky actually said that, you know, he used to say that, you know, we can't raise our kids like they live in Skver because we're more out in the world. But the people were very friendly and very nice. Mayor Schiller, if you know Mayor Schiller from YU, he's from Skver. They invited me to come for Shabbos to Skver. So my attitude is, if people want to do like that, I have nothing against it. If you want to live a certain, you want to live like a Gerach Hasid, you know, it's a free country, freedom of choice. If they want to, I went to New Square once. They have signs that men one side, women another side. They have a sign about how you're supposed to dress. These signs have no meaning in America. You can't tell people on a public road how to dress. But okay, they want to tell people. Very nice. That's Skver. And Skver, although they come from this extreme outlook, they're not. And they're not Zionists. They don't hold the Satmar Rebbe's ideas. The Satmar Rebbe holds, and real Satmar Hasidim won't go to the Kotel. They won't go to Hebron. They won't go to any of those places. When the Sfer Rebbe went a couple of years ago, you can see videos of it. He went to Hebron with about 1,000 Hasidim. He went to the Kotel. They like pushed everyone to the side, so he had a whole place. Very nice. Okay, Rav Baruch says that Rav Nosson Shimon was Menahel of Stolen, I think Hebrew or English, not only English, Hebrew and English. And he said online, it says he was principal. Yeah, I think he was principal, and he was really in charge of the English. I don't remember. Barry, who mentioned last week, since she spent a lot of hours interviewing Professor Sarah Schwartzman. I'm wondering why you call her a professor. Was she teaching at that time at one of the universities also? You can type it in. But I believe you are correct. Rav Schwartzman was a Haredi. Rav Schwartzman was a Haredi yeshiva. Women did not receive secular education. My only question: did he know this before he married her? Rabbi Rakefet has a story which I can't believe. Like so many of his stories, it's a great story, but I don't believe it. The story is that Rav Aaron Kotler was in Jerusalem, and he was giving a shiur, and some guy in the back was sitting very disrespectfully with his legs up. And Rav Aaron, after the shiur, came to him and said, the Kavod HaTorah, this is how you show Kavod HaTorah. Rav Dov Schwartzman said to him, when the Rosh Yeshiva can explain the Tosis properly, then I'll show Kavod HaTorah. And Rav Aaron was so taken by him and said he wants him as a chassan. It's a good story. It's good yeshiva lore. I can't believe it's true. And I can't believe anyone would speak disrespectfully like that to Rav Aaron Kotler. But I know someone who lived in Tekoa, and he was a student of Rav Dov Schwartzman. He was not a kitzoni at all. And the Shabbos I spent with him, such a kind person. I remember I got back to yeshiva on Monday, and I told the Rebbe who we were with for Shabbos, and he couldn't believe it, that Rav Aaron, she told me in response to Dr. Goon's question to me, their father, Rav Aaron, told her when she went to Barnard, go in health and be successful. Regarding from Hill Cutler, when I was in REITs, they spoke very negatively about this. A person from Adebrock told me she never recovered from this, and in some way it destroyed her life. Look, it's a tough thing. On the one hand, this is it's a family thing in the yeshiva. They built up Lakewood. Lakewood is huge, built up from nothing. And if he wouldn't go back to take it over, it's his inheritance. And not just because he wants to be a big guy or anything like that. It's the family yeshiva, and he had a responsibility in his mind to make it work. I mean, to go back there and keep the yeshiva going and build it. And him and his brother, they've been very, very successful. That's the way he looked at it. I don't think it ever occurred to him that his wife would say, no, I'm not going. And there's a halacha about a woman who doesn't want to leave Chutz Aretz, and she refused to take the get. You can read this. It created a huge issue. I don't know why it created a huge issue in the why it's not just a private thing. Obviously, well, I asked because I had to get the Heter Meir Rabbanim, but I don't feel comfortable talking about people's personal lives like that. But I understand why. I don't know why in REITs they would speak negatively. What do they care in REITs? If the couple decides they can't make it work. It's no different than if someone gets a job and they have to move down to, let's say, Peru. And the woman says, I can't go to Peru with you. And they can't figure out a way to make it work. And they get divorced. It's private. Yes, Ethan Tucker has to be from Zrari Chief Rabbin. Definitely. But when I was speaking about Adal, Mendel Shapiro, Ethan Tucker was not on the scene. He comes on the scene later. And he writes his responsum, makes a halachic argument for egalitarianism, that you can count women in a minyan. Yes, Rabbi Joel Roth, of course, is on the extreme right wing of the conservative movement. Mendel Shapiro article has implications for Kiddush clubs, roughly speaking. Let's see, how is that? If it is the community's responsibility to provide Torah readings so women, boys under 13, can read, and one need not hear the reading, if it is an individual obligation to hear the whole Torah reading, then it is inappropriate for a Kiddush club during Torah reading since the men need to hear the read. I don't know who this is. It just says IPIN. Other than Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, no one holds that, as far as I know, that there's an obligation on individuals to hear Kriyas HaTorah. That's famous. Rav Chaim held this. He used to get off a train to go hear it. Rav Chaim wasn't mocked on Minyan. He didn't think Minyan was a big deal. He would miss Minyan. That wasn't a big concern for him. But Kriyas HaTorah, Rav Chaim held that it was a mitzvah on the individual. He had a machokas with his mechutin, Rav Prisoner, Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather on the other side. So no one has an obligation as an individual to hear Torah reading, according to the standard view. So you shouldn't go to a Kiddush club simply because Kiddush clubs are very disrespectful. I grew up my whole life in my town. There never was a Kiddush club. I never heard of this till I was older. In Western Harts, New Jersey, we never had this growing up. The issue is that the Gemara speaks about already, you don't call up a woman for an aliyah to read, which means read the Torah because of kavod tzibur, the honor of the congregation. So what does kavod tzibur mean? And if it's kavod tzibur that the community will sort of not regard it as appropriate, most of the time we assume that kavod, you can be mochel on your kavod. You can say, well, it's my kavod, but I'm mochel. So there's arguments, and then we have sources in places where there are no men who know how to read the Torah. Can a woman, we're told that the woman should read it. So these are classical texts, either in Chazal or in Rishonim. So it's based on those reasons that they make the claim that, and in terms of boys under 13, in many Sephardic communities, boys under 13 read. Ashkenazim, we do not read. And even according to the Mendel Shapiro's argument, as if I recall correctly, it does not apply to boys under 13, because that's a minhag, a strong minhag that they've already given extra other reasons for it, not just covered at Seaborn. Been a long time since I looked at these issues. Shmuel asked, three rabbis replied. I sent it about to even maybe 15. I said 10. I think it was like 15. It was easy because all I did is I did it on my Hebrew word processor and I changed the name at the heading. So I just printed out like 15 and I sent them out. And Ellen says that the young Israel Brookline, everyone, including the rabbi, speaks after davening, unless there's some specific reason the speech needs to be before Musaf. In most shuls, though, that's not the case. Although whenever I speak places, since I'm not giving Divrei Torah, I'm usually giving more of the academic talks, I always tell them I want to speak after davening. And when I say after davening, that's almost always even before Adon Olam. It's just, in some of the shuls, they dafka want to do it after davening because then they do this liberal thing, progressive, they say the women can now come into the men's section. In some shuls, that's like a very big deal that the women have to come into the men's section. And Rabbi J. Kelman says that he had the pleasure of being a Nechama's student when he was in the Gerst Kollel. I think maybe you didn't have to be if you were there, but it's a big privilege and you're very lucky. Thomas asks, any thoughts on Forrest Assu's lectures at London Activities in 20s or 30s and the Ben Yishchai and the Bat Mitzvah, of course, at home. In that classes on the Ben Yishchai, we spoke about Forrest Assu. I even showed you the things she did. She spoke at Jews College. Jews College is hardly a Haredi institution. Forrest Assu, from the famous Assu family, was in London at this time. She corresponded halachically with the Ben Yishchai and Rav Hertz and Rav Hillman and others. She's the greatest Talmud Chacham as a woman, probably in the 20th century, at least in before the last decades of the 20th century. And this is before Art Scroll or anything. She was reading Sfarim. And she did give talks on Talmudic matters, but not to the Haredi team, as far as I know. But the Ben Yishchai communicated with her. And the Ben Yishchai mentions the Bat Mitzvah. Yes, the Ben Yishchai says that a girl should celebrate this. But he's talking about that it's not just a birthday. It's an event that now she's obligated in mitzvot. Someone asked me privately, what do I think of those that say Nechama Leibovitz would not have been that big deal if she was a man? Do you think that's fair or true?
No. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, Rabbi Kalman says no.
She was no.
And no she way. She was at the top. There were Golem who stood for her.
Correct. No, she could have been a Rosh Yeshiva.
But she wasn't a Halachas, a Posek, so she couldn't have been a Rosh Yeshiva. She wasn't a Talmudist. She was the first person really to focus on Tanakh, I think.
Believe me, she knew Talmud pretty well.
Yeah.
She never talked about it. She knew Talmud a lot better probably than whatever. Yes. Yeah. No, it's
but
not
I,
because
I have to woman. Though say that the fact that she was a woman, that made it a big deal for the women in particular. If she was, I don't think she would have been as big a deal if she was a man because the women looked to her as a model. And she was very inspiring. If she was just another man writing these books, the men might have looked at it significantly, but it wouldn't have had the effect it had. She was very influential for women. They created circles and they would print out, these were originally sheets that were sent out and they would study them. I don't think she would have had the great influence on the women in terms of creating women's Torah study if she was a man. So I do think that she would not have had the same influence. You disagree, Rabbi Kalman?
I disagree. The sheets were for the men also and for the male students.
No, I know that. But the question is, would she have taken off among women the way she did if this was a man writing? It seems to me that the fact that she was a woman is what gave the inspiration for many women to say, we too can be Torah scholars.
That may be true, but she was totally gender. Like she was a total non-feminist in the way we think of feminists.
But that's not the question. The question was,
that. But her knowledge of Tanakh, I don't think there was any Rosh Yeshiva who knew. I mean, that's not whatever. She was the expert on Tanakh.
Okay, when Rabbi Shach said that she should not give shiur on Tanakh, she made a grus. They came out when they attacked grus for this. She made a comment that I basically, I know more Tanakh, I don't need to go to the Rosh Yeshiva. That wasn't the question. The question was, and the question is not about would people regard her writings qualitatively the same as if she was a man or a woman. We're not talking about that. The question was, would she have been that important if she was a, and I don't think so.
Just yeah, that I would Rabbi agree, Sabato, that I might agree, but.
Rabbi Sabato, if the, who his Tanakh stuff, or other Mordechai, I think it's Mordechai Sabato. She was, I think that she became so famous also because she was breaking new ground. She was, I think that's, I don't think you can remove the fact that she was, a trailblazer, and trailblazers are always, get more, influence. Susanna says, if I'm not mistaken, it's common for Sephardim to take local issues into consideration when giving Pesach, so Basri might be reluctant to make a blanket statement. I don't just think it's Sephardim. I think it's every rabbi takes, they should at least, take local issues into consideration. We saw Rabbi Hananya, not as much, but any posek of any stature, or I shouldn't say maybe not, yeah, stature of any posek. I've never heard of a post-sake who didn't take individual things. You might not know it because you only hear about certain things, but they give all sorts of psukim. Even Rav Herschel Schechter, if I told you some of his things, some of his literal things, and Rabbi Kelman knows one in particular that he was involved with, but that's pretty well known about speaking in non-Orthodox shuls, but other things that Rabbi Schechter has done. So, and also Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and every post-sake. How can you be a post-sake without doing the considerations, local considerations? Baruch says, what was said in your youth in Tisha B'Av that they got rid of? Well, today we only read, how many, 10? We read a few of the piyutim, and the rabbi explains it. The kinos, we used to read many, many more. Yotzros are still set in places. Some places they do, but it's not like it used to be. I still remember growing up, even there was people wanted to say certain things. The conservative shul, Susanna says, in New Rosh Hashanah Yotzros 30 years ago, not anymore. The problem is that if people are just going to be sitting around and they don't understand it and talking, then it's sort of, you don't really gain much out of it. You lose a lot more than you gain because the Chil Hashem, if everyone's talking. In Budapest, in the old Dohani Shul in Budapest, they still do the Yotzros. If you go there once and you're on the Shabbos where they say it, again, you get an experience. They do it also. I was there for Shabbos. Rabbi Manfred in, he's in Kew Gardens, I think. He was a German rabbi for many years, or Forest Hills. Rabbi Manfred something or another in Queens. And that show we did Yotzros, I remember. First time I ever did Yotzros.
Rabbi Manfred Gens.
Gens, exactly, yes. We did Yotzros. I was there for scholar in residence, and it took us along. We did Yotzros. Do I know that Ilana Kagan had the first bat mitzvah in Lincoln Square? I did know that, but thank you, Daniel, for sharing it. So everyone who's watching now and everyone who listens will know it also, that Kagan was the first bat mitzvah. Question is, how did Adon take to these less than enthusiastic responses? I don't know. I just sent it. I just gave it to them, and they didn't do anything with it. They were going to be putting out a book. They wanted to, or some publication, approaches. I think this is why they wanted approaches to bat mitzvah, and they never ended up publishing it. And just Rabbi Kelman said, just read Tanya, the daughter of Aaron Lichtenstein's article on women in the Torah world, where she argues that we have to allow women to transition from the sideline to center stage in more realms, something she readily admits go beyond what her father would have allowed in the latest issue. This is in the latest issue of Tradition. Okay, I'll have to see. I don't know what that means. I guess it means becoming postcot.
You have to read the article. It's really quite a fascinating article. Basically, you know, if you give a woman a lulav and etrog, don't be surprised if she wants to do hakafas, you know, hoshanas. And if you teach her Torah, don't be surprised she's going to want to become a posek, like more or less. But it's I just read the article last night.
I'll have to see it. Since you mentioned hakafos, I'll tell a story to the people here. I find it interesting. In my show in West Orange, they had a guy who had smicha actually had smicha from Rav Badi, but was never part of the modern Orthodox world. So one year, someone asked him if Ataresa, if the women could recite Ataresa. After all, what's the problem? After the men finish reciting Ataresa, then the women would recite. Each woman goes around and reads a pasuk. It's not halacha, it's just that we're reading a pasuk. So from his Talmudic mind, without knowing anything really about the modern Orthodox world sociology-wise, he had just moved in, he didn't really know. He said, okay, he didn't see a problem with it. Then, of course, they explained to him that you can't have women reading Atzareis in a modern Orthodox shul. It's not about halacha at all. It's just that you can't have... Now, I don't know, maybe in 20 years, maybe even now, you could have women doing Ataresa. But there's an example of what I mean by Orthodox. It's not Orthodox for a woman to recite Ataresa, even behind the Machitza, even if you can't see her. But it's not halakhically improper, but it's certainly not Orthodox, at least. But if the Orthodox rabbis, big rabbis, were to say, we can now do it, they might even say we can do it because it's a way to keep the girls from, you know, leaving, going to the conservative. I mean, they wouldn't say that today, but you can imagine they say something else. Yes. Then it would be Orthodox. But it had one shul just decided to do it on their own. That would be the case I made about Jofa. Rebbetzin Yumreis spoke publicly to masses of men and women for decades and did great amount of kiruv. Of course, Rebbetzin Yumreis did it, but she's not speaking in a Haredi shul. In a Haredi shul, she couldn't do it. In the Haredi world, you can do that as long as you're outside. You could be a judge and be a so-called Hasidic woman, but don't think that you're going to speak before the men in your Hasidic shul about anything. It doesn't work that way. Chabad, incidentally, has broken this down a little bit in Beijing. Some of you I know have been in Beijing for Shabbos. And lo and behold, we're sitting there at the Kiddush, and who gets up and gives the Dvar Torah and gives the talk? The Rebbetzin. She's very dynamic. I haven't seen that in other places where she actually gives a Dvar Torah, but in Chabad, women speak a lot. Is there a class next Monday, Tzom Gedalia? Yes, there is a class. Thank you, Howard, for saying that Ksiv Achsima Tova. Yes, and this year should be a better year than the last year, and it looks like good things are coming, the vaccines, hopefully. Baruch says Rabbi Breuer had a parsha back and forth about Klal Kosher. Yes. Rabbi Breuer was very opposed to it. He said he wanted Glot Yashar. If you're going to be Glot Kosher, you have to be Glot Yashar. You have to be Glot in terms of economic, money matters. You have to be Glot in all the different ways, not just when it comes to food. He said, if you want to be that, then be everything else. When was I invited to Shabbos in New Square? When we were in Pressburg in Bratislava. The other famous thing that Rabbi Breuer is known for is that when they started having the separate seating at weddings, Rabbi Breuer said, fine, the married couples can sit separately. But the unmarried, they have to sit together. So at least from one chasana, we can have another chasana. So I don't know. As far as I know, Rav Mazuz is okay after in the hospital. A couple more things, everyone. Rabbi Wolkstein told us that he spoke before Inkal Kenu, so the last thing people hear in Shul are the words of Rabbi Lookstein. I guess the last thing they hear in Shul would be, though, Adon Olam, right? Rabbi Manfred Gant just passed away. I didn't know. Sorry. Okay, so some still say Yotzros. If it's the Minhag, if you're Ashkenaz, you should say it. But a lot of Shuls come from Ashkenaz, and they don't say it anymore. That was the only time I ever saw Yotzros. And Ellen says, and this is the last thing, she's been in modern Orthodox shuls where women said Ata Aresa. That's the sort of thing that you can even imagine centrist Rabbanim. If it was a post-scheme, if it was explained to them that in our community, you know, we're not in Teaneck or Bergenfield, that this is a thing that the women really want to do, you could very easily see that they could say this is a very small issue, it's not a big deal. They might even say this is better than giving them the Sefer Torah to dance with. I can see that. Okay, everyone. Kasim Lachsima Tova to all of you. And we will pick up next week on Monday. Thank you.